So I'm talking about the five hindrances. And I've been seeing things differently. And that's partly because is my understanding of what the Buddha taught when he explained this mindfulness meditation has clarified. Then it's become clearer why it's really relevant and useful to also to pay attention to the hindrances in that context. But first, I should explain what they are for anyone who doesn't know. And as the name suggests, the five hindrances are five difficulties we encounter on the path that we must work with or cope with in order to move ahead. And there are five because they're made up of two pairs of opposites and then one, a fifth, standing alone. And the two pairs of opposites, they kind of echo the core Buddhist teachings in many ways. The five are grasping and ill will, that's two, sloth and torpor, which is one, and restlessness on the other hand, so that's three and four, and then the fifth, which is doubt. And I want to suggest to you that how we look at these can be really transformational and can really bring it into practice. And in terms of this particular sharing, I want to give a huge amount of credit to Jill Fromsdahl. And there's a great book called Unhindered that you can buy or download or whatever you want to do, except it's not on Kindle. You can download it other ways. Unhindered, which in many ways kind of parallels what I've been thinking about, although, of course, Bill Fronsdell, he did it 25 times better. So it's a great book. And the one point, the key point of the book, and if you walk away with here remembering one thing, is that the hindrances are not a problem or a failure, but they're a doorway to awakening insofar as we bring them into our mindfulness practice. It's all about bringing them into our mindfulness practice, not fighting them, not anything other than that. How we bring them into our practice. And they are subjects for practice, and that's what brings us to freedom. And for me, the kind of the breakthrough came some time ago after been studying the Four Foundations of Mindfulness for a long time. And this is the Buddha's teaching on how to do this practice in the Satipatthana Sutta. And it, the fourth foundation kind of baffled me. It took me a long time to figure out what to do with it. So I kind of focused on the first three, which, as a lot of you know, is mindfulness of body, mindfulness of vedanas, which is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and mindfulness of states of consciousness. But the fourth one, it's like in the Pali version, it's different in the Chinese version, but in the Pali version, it's made of five lists. And what do you do with that, was my thought. And the five lists are the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense doors, the seven awakening factors, and the four noble truths. So that's 27 things. And I was just kind of, I just couldn't find the thread. But somewhere along the line, and of course from reading and studying, it really clarified that the fact that the first three, of the Four Noble Truths, of the four foundations, were about broadening our perspective on what to be mindful of, that extended to the fourth. And in fact, you know, sort of duh, but the whole point of the four foundations was to really stretch our perspectives about where to cultivate mindfulness. And of course, this may seem obvious to you folks, but once I got myself over that hump, then it was like that the hindrances were the first of the five, first of the five lists. Sorry, so many numbers here. I'm keeping a little track. First of the five lists, followed by the aggregates and the three sense doors. And those three are really important because they're all places where we trip up and get stuck in various ways. You know, the aggregates is all the ways, all of the different aspects of our sense of self. And if we get stuck there, if we're not mindful there, then it's really easy to fall into all kinds of selfing. And the sense doors, you know, it's distraction city, our five bodily senses and mind. and now they just pull us in, suck us in, and we wander off with all those things. But the hindrances is amazing because, you know, that's where we sort of founder in our own attitudes, in our own restlessness. And that's where the more I've seen this, it's been a real breakthrough. So, you know, it's that same thing about being mindful right in the middle of what's happening is where we see. And that's so perfect for we Westerners in complicated 21st century lives, not monastics, to really be able to work directly with these arisings. So I'm going to walk through the five with some suggestions about how we might work with them to a significant degree, called from Gill, who I consider one of my teachers. But he has a great quote in this book. He says, "When the hindrances are present, the path to inner peace is through them. Rather than viewing their presence as mistakes or obstacles, it is useful to turn toward them as if they are doors to walk through. They are the occasion for cultivating liberating insight and freedom." So right there, that just sort of nailed it in my mind, that paragraph, because that's exactly the attitude to hold. So the first is desire. And as many of you know, it's the same kind of close to attachment. Desire and attachment is a core reason for suffering, where we want stuff. We want conditions to be different. We're looking outside of ourselves for our well-being. And in the case of hindrances, there's an emphasis on sensual desire and the way that sense of things can become an obsession or an addiction for us. You know, and to whatever degree we're looking for a good experience, or we're having desire for something, that can really get in the way and become a hindrance in our practice. And I'm sure we've all, in various ways at various times, had versions of this come up. And there's nothing inherently wrong with desire. I mean, that's how we're built as beings. This desire is part of how we procreate and how we, you know, choose a ham or a peanut butter and jelly sandwich instead of a sandwich made of mud that we know the first will be better to eat. But desire is only a hindrance when it interferes with our ability to be present or to be mindful, to be present moment by moment and have insight. When desire is in the way of insight, then it's an obstacle on the path. But when desire arises, the trick here is, and where this is skillful to look at it in terms of mindfulness, is we're not trying to, it's not bad. We're not trying to stuff it down, push it away, throttle it, be angry at ourselves, be disappointed in ourselves, anything. We're just trying to bring our practice to it, to be mindful of it and see what it is. I mean, there may be skillful means to walk away or not act, you know, but the core is our practice. And that's what undercuts it and cuts through it, because ultimately this practice is about awakening and about extinguishing. You know, it's about nibbana, cooling. Nibbana is often translated as cooling. So cooling all the things that attach us. And desire is, you know, it's kind of the big apple. It's the starting point. That's why it's the first, perhaps, of the five hindrances. And, you know, for starters, just the very skills that we've learned in the four foundations, especially starting with body, you know, to really try to be mindful. Look inside. Where is desire arising? Where are you feeling it? Because it's often super physical. And we feel something buzzing in our body, in this part of our body or that part of our body that's wanting. But just to shift from feeling like you have to act on that to just watching it with interest. And it's enormously transformational right there. Just to be aware of that and to hold it. I think the brilliance of this is to be able to hold that in the frame of the hindrances, in the frame of the four foundations, it shifts the whole thing enormously. We're not kind of out on our own struggling with desire and feeling we're on the edge of defeat. We can really bring it into practice. And this helps us see, because a lot of times when we're experiencing desire, the object of our desire seems like it's just perfectly wonderful, whether it's, you know, a person of whatever our preferred gender is, or a very fast Italian sports car, whatever it is, it seems like just perfection. But when we really can settle into and feel what's going on, it starts to, you know, kind of dismantle, starts to take the edge off it. You know, the goal is always to be mindful and aware and not try to change things, but it can start to disconnect the grasping aspect of it. And sometimes as go deeper into our mindfulness, as we pay more attention, we might start to see that that desire is actually, there's something running underneath it. It can be kind of a displaced sense of what we want that may be coming from something else. Jack Kornfield talks about when he was a monastic in Thailand, and he was, well, dealing with a lot of sexual desire. He was in his 20s, and it was kind of plaguing him for a while. But at some point, he realized how much of it had a whole other layer that had to do with some difficulties in his childhood and feeling isolated, and a whole other aspect of heart longing. And so it really helped him work with the physical desire, because he saw it was something else, but he couldn't see that till he really was being mindful of what was presenting to him. So ill will is the opposite. And Gil is talking about it as a kind of an urge to strike out at something, or usually at someone, in as part of pushing away. And there's a bunch of colorful words he was sharing, like anger, fury, rage, resentment, indignation, irritation, vexation, discontent, loathing, or abhorrence. So it's very much in a human context. And Gills was suggesting, and it was really interesting about how he translates Pali words. The word, when I pronounce it, vyapada. I had never heard that word before, vyapada. Maybe you have. The Pali word that is often translated as aversion. But he was suggesting ill will is a better translation, because aversion isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, we can have a balanced sense of aversion to keep us from doing something that is unwholesome or damaging or dangerous. But ill will has a real negative, pushing away kind of judging kind of context. And this is, you know, to bring our mindfulness to that and start to feel again that, like, every single time it comes down to what do you feel in your body is always a place to start with any of these. But also when we sort of feel into it, you can see that there's often a sense of, there's a strong attitude of another that we're having ill will toward, and a concretizing of that being, and often some context where we think we're better than that other. So to kind of feel into those identities and how we're holding that can be really helpful. And also how laden with selfing this is. You know, ill will is this very strong sense of self in ourself and other. And we can start to see kind of how the three characteristics are unpacking a bit just by bringing it into our mindfulness practice. So it helps with that hardening of selfhood. Then sloth and torpor are the third. And restlessness, the fourth. And these are really interesting, because this is very much related to our experience of cultivating our meditation practice. I mean, these are kind of uniquely in the sphere of what we experience when we're trying to sit, or specifically anyway. And this sloth is more of a, well, here I'll quote Gill again. Sloth manifests as a physical absence of vitality. The body may feel heavy, lethargic, weary, or weak. Torpor is a lack of mental energy. The mind may be dull, cloudy, or weary, easily drifting in thought. So I'm sure every one of us has felt either or both of those at times when trying to practice. And it's not easy, but the thought of bringing that experience into mindfulness, or bringing mindfulness into that, can be very, I mean, there's antidotes. We'll talk about that a little bit, but also just to be mindful of it, even though it sucks, even though it's sort, it almost seems like an oxymoron. How can I be mindful of this when I am in the middle of sloth and torpor? But you kind of can. You can at least have the intent. You can get over the hump between just resistance or just disliking and cultivating mindfulness, even if it's uncomfortable and feels imperfect. It's still really, really useful, because we tend to feel like these are areas where we can really judge ourselves easily and think there's something wrong with us and compare ourselves to others and get frustrated and stop practicing, just give up. So to be able to just work on being mindful, to bring it up as much as it can, is really, really helpful. Because often these things are associated with negative thoughts about ourselves that can drain our vitality and kind of paralyze us. But if we can be mindful of those thoughts, and as they go by, it can really help take the wind out of their sails. And be mindful of the feelings can really help us not be sucked into them. And we can complement that with some actions. And the Buddha has these lists of actions, you know, a walking meditation, sort of sitting up and energizing ourselves more, splashing cold water in our face, looking up instead of down, looking up at the sky, different ways to bring energy. So this is an area where some antidotes can be useful. And he does say at the end, well, if none of this works, take a short nap, but then get up and practice. But be curious about it. You know, it's really an area to be curious about, just because it's so easy to judge ourselves and so easy to get kind of stuck in that heaviness. So to bring curiosity into the heaviness can be pretty amazing, because then it helps unlatch or unwind that locked in feeling we have that somehow we're lost in it. So I urge you to try. And then restlessness is on the other side of the spectrum. And again, it's something that probably all of us encounter in practice. This is my particular bugaboo. And the Pali word is udacha, U-D-D-A. I'll try this again. U-D-D-H-A-C-C-A, meaning to shake. Actually, I'm going to back up and spell another word, because that is helpful. So, okay, the word for the word for ill will is V-Y-A-P-A-D-A. V-Y-A-P-A-D-A. And I don't think I got sloth and torpor, but so that means, so back to restlessness, these U-D-D-H-A-C-C-A to shake. And it kind of really illustrates what the physical experience is. You know, when we're feeling restless, when that really strikes in practice, I don't know about you folks, but you have an impulse to fidget, to get up, to just get out of there. It feels like you had too much caffeine sometimes. But as much as we can to just bring mindfulness to that as opposed to just yielding to it. You know, it's often called monkey mind too, because there'll be a mental aspect of it and thoughts will really be going fast and just all these random thoughts from all over the place. It's often called monkey mind. But just to be able to be, just hang in there and be present with it and let it, let those feelings arise and see if we can just be present with them. You know, what a skillful means can be trying walking meditation in particular. I often personally do that when I just can't sit still anymore. If that's the case, and that can really be helpful because it really is a way we can bring our mindfulness to that and kind of embraces the restlessness. Gill says, here's a quote, learning to breathe through restlessness is a great skill. Breathing conscious of the whole body or focusing on the ongoing rhythm of breathing out and in can calm us physically. Releasing tension or constriction in breathing can be relaxing. The more attention given to breathing, the less attention is available to fuel the restlessness or worry. So, you know, experiment. But just think of it in terms of your practice and think of it in terms of being the fourth foundation. That just really puts a frame around it. It's really helpful. And then the fifth one, doubt, is important because when we don't work with it, it can derail our spiritual life entirely or our practice. And it happens to people. They just develop doubt and they stop. And doubt can be doubt about the teacher, doubt about the practice, doubt about our ability to fulfill the practice. And it's pretty skillful that, I mean, again, you know, the Buddha included, doubt is a thing in the five hindrances, really recognized how it does hit people and suggested to work with that mindfully to bring our attention to it and not just get stuck in all the stories. Because it often is a whole run of discursive thinking and we're having a debate with ourselves and we're fighting with ourselves and all these things. So it doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean be a sheep and sort of follow mindlessly what a teacher is saying if we have doubt. I mean, we have to look at it clearly ourselves, but it does mean bring our own creative awareness to it and see for ourselves. But recognize that that is a phenomena, you know, and whatever, if you have some form of that that comes up for you, you're among friends and it comes up for people for sure. Cause this is a, you know, this is a journey. And back in the day of the Buddha, it seems like people became arhats fairly rapidly and it's a little slower now, but it does happen. People do awaken in profound ways. So we have to, work with that doubt if it comes up. And here's, you know, once again, mindfulness of body. Just see where we're feeling it because it can be really tactile when we're having doubt. You can really feel it in your guts, this kind of resistance perhaps. And just to help us stay in the present and not spin out on whatever's on our minds. And of course, you know, that can be a good time to sit down and talk to a Dharma friend or a teacher, someone that you have some confidence in and talk it through and try to unwind it. But it's all kind of under the heading of mindfulness.